what we had just finished doing was figure out how to renormalize, in particular by adding local counter terms, local boundary counter terms to the space-time action. And we had shown how to do this for gravity so that we could get a renormalized stress tensor that would give finite answers for both the action, well, or finite answers for things like the mass up to the logarithmic divergence that we said was related to the conformal anomaly. So today, I would like to say what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about these issues of renormalizations and flows into the, and how the radial equations of motion in the space-time are related to RG, renormalization group flows in field theory. I'll just say a very small amount of things about that. And then I want to start talking about black holes in anti-de Sitter space and various aspects of their physics. So remember, using the stress tensor that we learned how to calculate, as well as by using these expectation values of operators in the conformal field theory in states associated with, you know, classical objects in the space-time, we basically found out that scales in the conformal field theory were, okay, were related to, were related to radial positions in the bulk space-time, with the boundary of the space being associated with the ultraviolet and the deep interior being associated with infrared. So I'm going to explore that some more. So roughly speaking, from that, what we would love to get is some sort of idea that if you had a renormalization group flow of a conformal field, of a deformed conformal field theory, namely if we move ourselves away from the conformal point by adding some sort of deformation to the conformal field theory that breaks conformal invariance, then we would somehow like to be able to see that this must be related to the radial flow of the solution. Because at least that's the qualitative connection that we've already uncovered yesterday, and particularly yesterday evening in the various calculations that we did. And it would be nice if that could be made more precise. Better still, we would like to see, it would be wonderful if there was a direct relationship between the renormalization group equation of the field theory, that's dual to ADS space, and the radial equation of motion. Now, I'd love to be able to tell you about this in detail, but I cannot because there's an enormous literature on this kind of thing, and there's just not enough time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to list a series of references and give you an argument that a connection like this has to be true. So some of the references that are relevant are 99.03190, and there's 99.12012. This is DeBoer, Verlinde, Verlinde. And these two papers give general arguments as to why there should be some relationship between the renormalization group equation for the field theory and the radial equation of motion. There are several papers by Skinderis and collaborators on et al. On holographic renormalization, which also try to set up the formalism in detail. And then there's a huge literature on actual solutions by Pilch, Warner, Friedman, Gubser, Skinderis, Skinderis, and many others. I'm surely doing someone an injustice by not listing their name, in which people write down specific solutions to five-dimensional gravity that are related to specific deformations of the four-dimensional field theory, and then demonstrate, and then those are people typically look at deformations in which you know that in the UV there's a conformal point at which you've deformed away from, and then when you float in infrared in the field theory, the renormalization group flow lands you up at another conformal fixed point. And then what people do is they work out the solutions of the equations of motion in space-time and show that near infinity and the deep interior, the solution changes character in precisely the manner necessary to match the properties of the two different conformal fixed points, in particular the conformal dimensions of operators or the scalings of fields act in the right way to mimic that flow. So I'm not going to go through that in detail because that by itself is a series of lectures in its own right. So the whole Klebanov-Strassler type of solutions, all these n equals 1 confining solutions, things like this, fall within this class of thinking, and I'm not going to go through that in detail. Since I don't have the time, I'm going to give you basically a schematic argument trying to show you that it should be the case that the diffeomorphisms of space-time, namely the freedom that we have in making coordinate transformations in space-times, are somehow directly related to a local renormalization group a set of local renormalization group schemes for the field theory, for the dual field theory. So I'm going to give you a schematic argument for this, and the specific cases worked out here give sort of beautiful realizations of this sort of ideas in very concrete terms. You can work out everything about the solutions, and you can work out the solutions in detail and see that all the scaling dimensions work out correctly. So the way I'm going to give you this argument is, first of all, let me look at Euclidean anti-de-Sitter space. And here's Euclidean anti-de-Sitter space. It's a ball. And what I want to consider is, okay, I'll tell you what I want to consider in a second. So normally, the way we define, as we've said many times now, the ADS-CFT correspondence in anti-de-Sitter space, is we say that we integrate over all fields in anti-de-Sitter space, e to the is, subject to the boundary condition that the fields phi approach some boundary value on the outer surface here. And then we say to ourselves that, so let me call the boundary value here phi 0, so the fields approach phi 0, and this defines some functional whose derivatives tell us the correlation functions of the dual field theory, right? We've said this now many times, and we used this in great detail in the lecture last evening. So what is the renormalization? So now we have the rough idea that moving towards the interior is motion into the infrared in the field theory. So normally, if we're doing field theory, how do we think about the renormalization group in general? Well, one of the most powerful ways of thinking about the renormalization group in field theory is to go to Euclidean signature and then take the Wilsonian approach. Namely, what you do is, in Euclidean signature, to come to the infrared, you literally go to the path integral and integrate out momentum modes in the UV. You systematically integrate out the ultraviolet and get a low-energy effective action describing just the infrared modes, and that gives you the flow of the theory towards the infrared. I mean, that's literally what you do. You integrate out the UV, and you get some IR theory. So let's see how you might mimic that procedure in anti-de-Sitter space, given our understanding that somehow the outer reaches of the space are related to the UV in field theory, and the inner regions are related to the infrared. So what we could do is let me cut off the space somewhere at some position epsilon, and the physics inside here is more to the infrared, and the physics outside here, if you like, is more to the UV. And I'm going to define a new generating functional, z tilde, in the following way. I'll split this path integral into degrees of freedom phi in, which are the field degrees of freedom inside the surface, and degrees of freedom phi out, which are the degrees of freedom outside the surface. And now I'm going to do the path integral, e to the is, and I'm going to simply do the path integral over the outside degrees of freedom. So just like in the Wilsonian formalism, we are taught that, you know, just do the path integral over the UV degrees of freedom and derive an effective action. I now do the path integral over the exterior degrees of freedom in the bulk spacetime and get an e to the is effective. Yeah, z tilde is equal to e. That's true in the Wilsonian setup, too. It's always the case that the functionals are the same. The only difference is when you write down a partition function, you have to make it a functional of something. The only question is going to be, what are we going to make it a functional of? So here, we were going to make things a functional of phi naught, the values over there on the outer boundary, right? Those are the sources, the ultraviolet sources, if you like. Now, we're going to make the z tilde functionals of the values of the field on the inner surface, call them phi epsilon. Okay? So, indeed, so then we should be able to say that if I define z tilde to be the integral as phi goes to phi epsilon, again, I'm fixing now the boundary values in this inner surface, as phi goes to phi epsilon, of e to the I s effective, integral phi in, then I should be able to define this, you know, just reading, you know, just following my nose about the renormalization group, this should be e to the I generating function of correlation functions as a functional of these sort of infrared sources. And I'm basically writing down exactly what I would have written down in the Wilsonian renormalization group, integrate out UV, and write things as a functional of sources for the infrared fields. Okay. All right, so now, in order to be able to, so what I want to do, the renormalization group is a relation, can be understood, at least one way of thinking about it, is as a relation between the correlation functions for operators that you would have computed in the UV and the same, and the correlation functions for the similar operators that you would have computed in the infrared. In other words, you compute a correlation function and ask how it flows in scale from UV to IR. So I would like to ask such a question here. To do that in this current setting, I need to be able to relate the values of the fields in the bulk spacetime on the boundary at infinity to the values of the field on the surface epsilon. Right? I need to find some relationship between them to derive an equation for flow of things. So how do we do that? Well, okay, here's the way we do that. Remember, we defined in the first or second lecture the bulk boundary propagator, which was a propagator that told us how to propagate a delta function disturbance in from the outer boundary inside. This was the bulk boundary propagator that we made a big deal of. It was the, if you like, the non-normalizable mode defined such that there are no singularities in the interior. Okay? That's what propagates data from the outside in. Okay, using that bulk boundary propagator in the present case has the form, if you want to propagate from the outside surface to a surface at fixed epsilon there, it looks like epsilon to the power delta over epsilon squared plus b minus b prime squared to the power delta. B and b prime are points on this boundary, and b prime is points on that boundary. And so what does this look like? It looks like a smearing of some kind. If here is the surface at infinity, at the boundary, and here's the surface, cutoff surface inside, a point disturbance there spreads out to some degree on the inner surface. Okay? That's what the bulk boundary propagator says. So we can write phi epsilon at the surface b prime, whatever data you specify for your infrared correlation functions, if you like, is going to be the integral over the boundary at infinity of all the boundary points, you know, square root of the metric g bulk boundary epsilon b prime 0 b of data on the boundary at infinity. In other words, this is a coarsened version of the data at infinity phi naught. Already you can see where an RG-like effect is going to happen. Another way of thinking about a normalization group is that, you know, is the block spin idea. You give me an n-dimensional Ising model, and I make block spins and coarsen the variables, and that flows me to the infrared. So already you can see something like that is bound to happen here. Okay, so now I'm going to define correlation functions. I'm going to define the correlation function Cn at the position epsilon, if you like, to be the correlation functions of the operators associated with this surface, namely with this inner surface, so they're the infrared operators in some sense, so is going to be the variations of this thing, log z tilde, with respect to phi epsilon to the n. I'm basically doing exactly what I had done before. I'm mimicking all the formulae that we defined at infinity, except I'm doing this at some inner surface. Phi naught is a function of b. Thank you. Excellent. Okay, so now I want to sort of do a calculation. What does this actually do? And of course, since the path integral, what I really want to do is to do the path integral in this outside region, but that's very difficult to do. So what I'm of course going to do is I'm going to go to the semi-classical limit, and I'll study this. I'll study what contribution integrating out this outside region makes in the semi-classical limit. So that S effective then is more or less the integral over these regions where R is less than epsilon, if you like, or Z is, over the interior, D interior, of the standard, of the Lagrangian of the bulk theory, plus some outer contribution from the outer region, but some classical outer contribution as a functional of phi epsilon. So the way we're going to do this is, given the data phi epsilon, we're simply going to find the classical solution that interpolates between phi epsilon and whatever it does at phi naught. You know, we can do that using this bulk boundary propagator. And then we're just going to integrate up the classical action and add it in as a classical piece there. Okay, so again, if here's the inner region and here's the outer region, we just integrate the action here, add this as a functional of phi epsilon. And that's a simple exercise that you're putting in, let's say, for a scalar field, the d phi squared plus n squared phi squared, then you write phi epsilon in this language, and then you integrate up the classical equations of motion. Okay. So let's see what happens. What this effectively does is, I'm not going to work out those details, they're fairly elementary, and that is an exercise for you to be able to carry out, since it's an exercise in computing classical actions. And if you do that, what you find is that these correlation functions, O epsilon, associated with the inner surface, are going to be, basically turn out to be, the correlation functions of a set of coarsened operators. Namely, in effect, what you've done is if you're taking the correlation functions of the original operators O, defined in the ultraviolet, which were dual to the fields phi, and instead of doing the usual variation with respect to the boundary data phi naught at infinity, if you do this variation with respect to this interior data, it amounts to computing correlation functions of operators that have been smeared in this way by the bulk to boundary propagator. You literally coarsen the operators and you do a calculation. But that's effectively what you've done. So if you do this, for example, just to be concrete, if you do this in Poincaré coordinates, which we have used many times now, then you know you have these Poincaré slices that are going in. So here's the Poincaré slice, and each Poincaré, as you decrease, as z goes to zero at infinity, that's the boundary at infinity, and as z increases, you're going in into the interior. You can write an equation that says of the following kind. If you work out what the bulk to boundary propagator is, and I've written it there, and you plug it in into this equation, and you work out what happens, it turns out that the endpoint correlation function that we've written down here, in momentum as a function of epsilon, the position you are, and k1 through kn, satisfies the following equation. Epsilon dd epsilon minus n, the conformal dimension minus the dimension of the space we're in, plus a sum on I, epsilon dd epsilon, of logarithm of 1 plus f qi squared. I'll explain all of these terms in a second, where q squared is equal to, you know, k squared. This is q is equal to k, q is equal to square root of k squared. K here being the momentum of the each operator, times cn of epsilon k1 through kn is equal to 0. So do you recognize this equation from field theory? Remember, what we've done is a calculation in gravity where I've just asked the question, if I vary the action for gravity in the gravity side with respect to the boundary data here versus the data at some interior surface, and ask myself the question as to how the variation changes when I move from the outside to the inside. This is the equation that governs, the differential equation that governs how the variation with respect to the external data changes as you move towards the interior. So what this equation should remind you of, or this, what this equation is identical to, is the Callan-Simancic equation. If you had given me a field theory in which you had computed the endpoint correlation functions, and then written down the Callan-Simancic equation for it, it would take this form. Specifically, you would have, this is where the scaling part comes in, right? This is saying that the if this term wasn't there, you'd be finding the correlation function scaled. And this is the part that describes the violations of scaling. Okay? So specifically, so we're seeing that right here. So in other words, this takes the form of a Callan-Simancic equation. Now, one interesting point is that in the gravity picture of doing things, instead of moving in these surfaces uniformly, you know, like this, etc., we could move it in a wiggly way. Right? So what does that mean from this renormalization group perspective? Well, what that means, so what one would propose this means is the following thing, that the diffeomorphisms of space-time, which are what allow you to go from surfaces that are nice and symmetric like this to wiggly surfaces like this, are in one-to-one correspondence with scheme dependence of local renormalization group flows in the field theory. What are local renormalization group flows, as opposed to the usual renormalization group flows that we almost always talk about? So usually, when we talk about renormalization group flow, we think about it in terms of going to the infrared uniformly in the entire theory. So for example, if I was doing the spin system analogy, and you know, you start off with a bunch of spins on each point, when you go to the infrared, what you normally do is you do block spins, let's say, where you take these four spins and you pretend they're one spin, take these four spins, you think they're one spin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You take blocks of spins uniformly. But no one told you you had to do that. It may be convenient, and indeed, people who do lattice simulations do this kind of thing all the time, where what you do is, in some regions, when you make your block spins, so let me draw this again, here you're making 4x4 block spins. In some regions, let's say you make a bigger block, and in some regions, you make a smaller block. Right. Nobody stops you, when you go to the infrared, from doing that inhomogeneously from point to point. And this is called local renormalization group flow. And in particular, in field theory, studies of this have been done by Osborne and Erdmenger at Cambridge. And there is, of course, a huge scheme dependence if you choose to do renormalization group this way, because, of course, different people can choose to coarsen their theory in different ways, you know, different patterns of coarsening at different points. And so it seems very natural that that scheme dependence of local renormalization group flows of field theory should be directly related to the freedom of, well, diffeomorphisms in the bulk space-time. So that here an ambiguity in the bulk theory, namely diffeomorphisms, is related to an ambiguity of the space of renormalization group flows over the field theory. Okay. So now this was an abstract discussion, and I don't have the time in these lectures to give you specific examples where things like this work out. I do recommend various of the papers that I put up earlier because they give explicit examples where the relevant scalings occur as you flow from one interesting field theory in the UV to another field theory in the IR. Did you have a question? Yes. Okay. So let me comment again how I derived this equation. This is also there in one of those references, so you could look at it there. So what I did is, what we need to do is we need to take this action and vary it with respect to phi epsilon. So to do that, well, there's the interior part of the action that we've got to write down, right? We've got to evaluate this action, the action on shell as a function of data on this inner surface. That's easy to do because you write down a solution, and then you sort of integrate by parts to find the value. And then you've got to find the outer contribution. To find that, what you need to know is, given the data phi epsilon on this inner surface, you need to be able to extend that data to phi naught on the outer surface by solving the classical equations of motion. So you need to do that extension. And then you need to plug that into the classical action for this exterior region. You see what I mean? So you're given the data on the inner surface. You're given some data here. So then you need to solve the classical equations of motion in the exterior and with this data and extend it out to something else there. Then compute the action for that whole thing on shell, right? And that's the contribution from the exterior region. You plug it in, and then you vary the whole thing. It's a little bit of a mess, which is why I'm not doing it on the blackboard. But if you do it, this is, and then boil that down to a differential equation, this is the differential equation you will find. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. The question that was being asked here is that in the previous lecture, particularly last evening, I emphasized that almost any quantity you wish to compute diverges. Any interesting quantity, any expectation value or correlation function actually diverges when you try to compute it in ADS-CFT because composite operators, of which you're computing expectation values, come equipped with a short distance divergence in the definition of the operator, and that needs to be removed. So strictly speaking, when I talk about the actions that I'm using here, I'm using the actions with the relevant boundary terms added to make the action finite. So we've dealt with the definition of the operator, right? So in field theory, if you want to talk about renormalization group flow for composite operators, first you define the operator, and then you ask how its correlation functions flow, going from UV to IR. So here, the whole techniques that were described in the last lecture are used to define the operator, and then you can use this kind of technique to talk about its flow. Again, I'm making here a very general argument that I hope is more convincing than one or two specific examples. We're going to take in the other option of working out a couple of specific examples. But basically, for this reason, it will always turn out that the radial flow equations resemble the equations of a renormalization group flow. And then, in specific cases where you've got interesting flows between one supersymmetric theory and another supersymmetric theory of the conformal points, you can check that all the correct scaling dimensions, et cetera, are worked out. Okay, question. Yeah. If you do what? Wilsonian schemes always generate non-local actions. So specifically, if you look at this term that you're going to get here, there's no, I mean, it is not going to be, in general, finite in the number of derivatives it has. So the effective action is, in principle, always non-local. It's just that the higher derivative terms are usually suppressed by suitable powers of scale. So you can try to ignore them. But they're all there. And so it's the same here. Okay. Question? Yeah. Okay, so there are a couple of comments to be made there. First of all, we have to be a little careful. This relates to a little mumble I made in my first lecture, which is that it's actually not true that the plane is conformal to the cylinder. It's that the plane with points at infinity identified is conformal to the cylinder, and that issue will come back to bite you here. Because, for example, there's an issue of the conformal anomaly, and what will happen is that when you go from the plane to the cylinder, the diffeomorphisms you're talking about in the space-time are conformal transformations in the boundary. So you have to take care of the conformal transformations at the same time. There's a conformal anomaly that you've got to deal with also, which depends on the points at infinity being identified. So you can take care of that also. It's just a conformal transformation you need to do in the field theory. But you have to be aware that the point at infinity is identified. One more question, and then I should move on. Yeah. What's that? How's the F function? So the F function here is an expansion in powers of momentum of that thing. Here I wrote this in position space. You can Fourier transform this into momentum space, and when you do that, the F function will appear in an appropriate fashion. Okay, good. So just to finally nail this in, I'm going to give you guys an exercise of which I'm going to work out bits, and then you should do this because it's instructive, and then we will move on to start talking about black holes and anti-de-Sitter space. So the exercise that I'm going to give you guys is essentially dimensional analysis, but it's a very interesting exercise in dimensional analysis. You know, in renormalization group flow, what we often say is that, when you integrate out UV degrees of freedom, you're left with fewer IR degrees of freedom. So somehow here we should have the intuition that describing the interior requires fewer degrees of freedom, or, different numbers of degrees of freedom or something. And we'd like to make some estimate of how the number of degrees of freedom required to describe a region in ADS space flows. How many degrees of freedom in the field theory do you need to describe some region in ADS? Okay? So that's something that should somehow come out of this kind of thinking. So I am here going to mimic an argument given in a very nice paper from many years ago by Susskind and Witten. So that's the place where you can look if you have trouble completing the exercise. So here's what we're going to do. Here's anti-de-Sitter space, and now let's work in global coordinates. In d plus 1 dimensions, that's minus 1 plus r squared over l squared dt squared, plus the same thing inverse dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And let me cut the space off at r equals l. Actually, this is so easy to do that I'm actually just going to do it on the back. So, we're going to cut it off at r equals l. So what is the area of the sphere at r equals L? Well, if r is equal to L, then the area of that surface is equal to L to the power d minus 1 times the unit sphere. Right? That's, so this is, I should say, this is for ADS d plus 1. So this is a d minus 1 sphere. Okay, that's evident. Yeah, sure. Better? So that's the area. Now, I want to compute the volume contained within this region. If you compute the volume within this region, well, what's that? The volume is equal to the integral of that sphere times the integral from 0 to the position L, dr. And here I'll put in root det g. That will give me r to the d minus 1 over square root of 1 plus r squared over L squared. And so that goes like s d minus 1, L to the power d minus 1 times the ADS scale for large L. So we see from this that the scaling with the cutoff is the same in both cases. Namely, the area scales with the cutoff like the volume. So the question is, what does this mean for the number of degrees of freedom required to describe a region of anti-de Sitter space? Again, following along the same thinking about, you know, renormalization group flow to the infrared. Okay, so at the naivest level, we said in the first lecture that the naivest statement of what holography is that the number of degrees of freedom required to describe a region goes like the area of the boundary of that region divided by g Newton. In many cases, this is too naive, and as I mentioned, there are suitable generalizations by Busso and others for more interesting cases, but in this situation, that's sort of basically correct. This is what the holographic bound on the number of degrees of freedom required to describe a region should be. Okay, so now let's consider the specific case of ADS5 cross S5. And remember that in the solutions that we've been writing down, this thing has a scale L given by G string N to the quarter L string. And this thing also has a scale L. So now remember also that the five-dimensional Newton constant that I've put here is the 10-dimensional Newton constant divided by the volume of the S5, the standard Kaluza-Klein ology. So that gives us G10 divided by the ADS scale of the sphere scale to the fifth. So let me reorganize that. What this means is that, so let's write this is G string, L string to the eighth. Now I'm going to drop all my 2 pi's and whatnot. And in the denominator, we have G string N to the 1/4. L string. I want to leave this for a moment. I don't want to work this out yet. Okay, let's just take these things for granted. Now, let's write our cutoff that we've put in the space-time, the cutoff L, in terms of units of the ADS scale. So let's write this as L over delta. So delta is a dimensionless parameter that essentially encodes how many ADS volumes, if you like, how many ADS curvature scales have been included within the cutoff region. Is it 1, is it 50, is it 10,000, et cetera? And that's encoded by delta. Okay, so now let's work out what the entropy is supposed to be. So the number of degrees of freedom then, n degree of freedom, is equal to area over G5. And the area over there is, in this case, I guess it's L cubed times, let's just deal with the scaling, so I won't deal with the volume of the sphere. It's L cubed divided by G phi. So in this language, then that's L, that's the ADS scale cubed divided by delta cubed, times, using this, it's ADS scale to the fifth divided by the 10-dimensional Newton constant. And now this will become a convenient thing. This is L to the eighth, so that gives us G string N squared times L string to the eighth divided by G string squared L string to the eighth. So that cancels. Oh, and there's a delta squared in the denominator. And you know what? Maybe I will put back the volume of the SD minus 1. Here's SD minus 1. So that turns into N squared over delta squared, delta cubed, SD minus 1. OK, now remember that the ADS5 cross S5 theory is dual to the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, which has, of course, N squared degrees of freedom in of order N squared degrees of freedom in its matrices, right? I mean, it's N by N matrices, and therefore they're of order N squared degrees of freedom. So now recall that the SUN Yang-Mills theory is of order N squared degrees of freedom. So what it appears to be is that the instruction we're getting here is that, roughly speaking, the number of degrees of freedom you need to describe some region is you take that region, you take its boundary, and you chop up that boundary into regions, each of which is Planck-sized. And then if you associate with each of these Planck-sized regions of the boundary an n squared degrees of freedom, you will recover this count. That's essentially what has been said here. So in other words, what you can see here explicitly in any case is that as you go off to infinity, so the cutoff goes to 0 towards infinity. Sorry, as the cutoff goes, so in this description, r going to infinity, little r going to infinity, is the boundary of anti de Sitter space. So delta going to 0, is equal to going to the boundary of the space. And delta going to infinity is going towards the interior. And so you can see that as you go towards the boundary of the space, you need more and more degrees of freedom. But it's always proportional to n squared. And then as you go into the deep interior, you get less and less degrees of freedom. And the rough count is if you chop off into sort of Planck-sized area of the boundary of any region, and then count n squared degrees of freedom for each of those, this is what you will get. So once again, we have some sort of justification for moving towards the interior. This is a qualitative argument now, but moving towards the interior is somehow requiring fewer and fewer degrees of freedom. And in particular, if you pursue this all the way to one ADS volume, it would suggest that you need precisely n squared degrees of freedom, which somehow is like saying that all you need is a big matrix worth degree of freedom to describe one flat space region. Because if you're inside the ADS scale, then the space is essentially flat. And what that connects to is an even more ancient development, which is the BFSS matrix model, where it was claimed that flat 11-dimensional space can be described by the dynamics of a large matrix. So there's a very nice qualitative connection here between flowing to the deep infrared and getting just one matrix degree of freedom and the description of flat space in a non-perturbative way. OK, so that's it. So this was that's it for renormalization and going to the infrared and the scale radius business. So now's the time to ask questions about that. And then I'm going to switch to talking about black holes. Yes? What's that? The central charge of this gauge theory will be related to n squared, because there are n squared gluons in the system. In the ADS3 case, you'll get the appropriate central charge of the D1, D5 string. Any more questions? About this picture? Yeah, in this diagram, what I'm trying to say is that if you now carry out the exercise of going to cut off the space at a region L, at a size L, find the surface area there, and then block off that surface area into Planck-sized cells. So in other words, block off the surface area into little blocks, each of which has a length of the sides L Planck. So you can count how many Planck areas live on the boundary of a region of radius L. OK? I should have said, I didn't do that. I didn't do that here. That's an exercise that you guys should do. That's the easy exercise for you to do. Count them. And then you will see that if you multiply that number by n squared, you will reproduce this number. Okay? So it's as if what you need is for each Planck cell, you put in n squared degrees of freedom, so to speak, and that will suffice to describe the entire volume inside. Okay? Again, it's a qualitative argument that is very pretty. Yeah. To the degree of lambda. What's lambda? Why does the delta cubed? That's coming, that's also very nice. So if you think about this, the delta cubed is to some degree, you know, it's coming from this thing here in ADS5 is 3, right? So the delta cubed is coming precisely because this is an S3. And so if you chop this up into regions at any scale you want, then you're going to get the cube of the side length. So delta is acting here like it's counting how many grid regions you can put on the sphere. So that's the cube. There's no direct justification of that from the quantum field theory. That's what you're asking. Yes, I don't understand how that comes about from there. I'm just telling you from this picture, it makes some kind of sense. Yeah, so, well, to understand this properly, it's not clear how to understand this directly from the field theory. Because always here, we're talking, so to speak, about the theory happens to be in its vacuum. And you need to derive some kind of bound for, suppose you put all kinds of physics that you could imagine in the interior of this region, and you describe that physics in the quantum field theory dual, then how many degrees of freedom would you have needed in the quantum field theory to hypothetically describe anything that could happen within this region? And the CFT is not very well set up to answer such a question. What you might do is, of course, you might try to flow the CFT, suitably deformed in order to represent all kinds of physics on the inside, into the infrared, and see how many degrees of freedom survive. But that's a hard thing to do because you're at strong coupling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, for me, this is a very nice qualitative argument that gives me some good intuitions. And it indeed gives very powerful intuitions in many cases, but that's it. I have no further precise calculation that can be suggested in the field theory. Well, it doesn't matter how long is it, so long as ADS is infinite. You can add states, you can add deformations, and this is the number of degrees of freedom that you're supposed to need to describe everything within that region. That's the claim. Okay? And again, it's just naively reading off the consequences of assuming holography implies this fact. Any more questions? Okay, let's change directions and start talking about black holes in ADS space. It's actually not a complete change of direction because you'll find that almost everything we've said will start recurring again. So, so there we are. Okay. So now I want to discuss black holes in ADS5. We could, of course, discuss black holes in any dimension ADS space, and there's been a tremendous amount of work done on this subject over the last few years. Three dimensions is special, because the only black holes there are things made by orbifolds. There are these BTZ black holes, and there are very nice things to be said about that. There are nice things to be said about black holes in 4 and 7 higher dimensions also, but I'm not going to do any of that. I'm also not going to talk about black rings, which is a very exciting subject that's arisen recently. And I'm going to restrict myself to black holes and anti-de Sitter space, because my writ is to talk about the ADS CFT correspondence. So let's start talking about the Schwarzschild black hole in ADS. And while we do this, we learn many general things about black holes and ADS spaces in general. So there'll be some general set of rules and tools that you can take away from this discussion for all dimensions. But it's nicer here to work with a specific example. So we wrote up the metric for this black hole yesterday, but let me write it again. It's 1 plus r squared over l squared. This is the usual behavior that you get in the global anti-de Sitter space. Minus r naught squared over r squared, dt squared, plus the same thing inverse, the r squared, plus r squared d omega 3 squared. As pointed out by somebody yesterday, this is Schwarzschild coordinates, and you have to do the maximal Kruskal extension if you want to get the whole space. So if I draw a Penrose diagram, by the way, how many of you are comfortable with Penrose diagrams? Okay, many of you, those of you who aren't, I'm not going to develop Penrose diagrams here. I'll describe what's being drawn here, but I highly recommend you go learn about them. Extremely useful tool. This is the Penrose diagram for the maximally extended black hole. this is the singularity, that is the past, future singularity, the past singularity. This metric in the region R bigger than the horizon describes this region. When R is less than the horizon, it describes this region. And you can analytically extend the space-time to go to this region and this region. This is the boundary. And there is another boundary here, as there usually is for the maximally extended black hole. There are two boundaries to the maximally extended space-time. Each of this is a cylinder, S3 cross R. Okay? There are two cylindrical boundaries. The way you read these diagrams, for people who are not familiar with them, is the picture is light rays in these pictures move at 45 degrees. And hence, if a light ray goes in here, it gets stuck and doesn't get back up. This is the only thing I'm going to use it for. So, well, I won't say any more about Penrose diagrams. The mass of this black hole we computed yesterday using this counterterm method. And we found that the answer was 3 pi r naught squared over 8 g newton. This is the five-dimensional g newton, plus 3 pi l squared, l being the ADS scale, divided by 32 g newton. And we further said that after boiling things down appropriately, this was 3 pi r naught squared over 8g, this is the mass associated with the sort of black hole-ness of the thing, plus 3n squared over 16l. And we explained that in this way of computing masses, this quantity computes the Casimir energy of the dual field theory. In other methods of computing the masses, such as background subtraction, you always refer the masses of all spaces to be relative to a certain background space. In this case, that would be anti-de Sitter space. And that's effectively, for our purposes, simply just canceling this thing out. OK. In any case, this is what I'm going to use. We can work out what the horizon is of this black hole. And the horizon, of course, is where this factor vanishes. So that's a quadratic equation, easily solved. And you find that the horizon radius squared is equal to L squared, that's the ADS scale squared over 2, minus 1 plus square root of 1 plus 4 r naught squared over l squared. So let's draw a picture to explain this formula. Here's a picture of r horizon squared as a function of r naught. And not surprisingly, as you crank up r naught, which is related to the mass, as you increase the mass of the black hole, the horizon radius does something like that. Specifically, when the mass, when this length scale R naught, which is related to the mass, is much less than the ADS scale, you find that the horizon radius squared scales like R naught squared. So RH is basically proportional to R naught. That's for the small black holes. And when R naught is much, much bigger than L, the R horizon squared goes like L R naught. While some of the specific relations here are going to be specific to ADS5 because of a particular form of the metric, et cetera, many of the statements I make about the qualitative behavior of these things will be general. Okay. I now want to compute some facts about the thermodynamics of these black holes. So I'll first of all go to the Euclidean section. So that's essentially taking plus 1 plus r squared over l squared minus r naught squared over r squared dt squared plus the same thing inverse dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. That's the Euclidean version of the black hole. And you should recall, or look up, if you haven't studied it before, that when you go to the Euclidean section of the black hole, you have to be careful about what to do with time. So I'm now going to relabel t as chi. And as r goes to r horizon, I have one new message. Brilliant. Well, that threw me off my stride. As R goes to R horizon, you get conical singularities you know, these cell phones, they're really Pavlovian. You know, once you get used to your phone ring, if the thing goes off, you go, blah! And you sort of, you look at what have you, anyway. So as R goes to R horizon, you're going to get conical singularities in general, unless you compactify chi, the erstwhile time direction, with a particular period. So as an exercise, what I would like you to do is the following. Look at the R chi plane near near R horizon, near R equals R horizon. And then what you should do is you should change coordinates so that the metric there looks like d rho squared plus d chi squared times, you know, rho squared times something. And then you should figure out what the period of chi should be. So this looks almost like just a regular, you know, polar coordinates for a plane. And you should figure out what the periodicity of chi should be in order to make this just a normal plane. So you should do that exercise. But I'm going to tell you the answer because I need the answer. This is the most efficient way of computing the temperature of black hole. So the answer is that chi must be identified with the period 2 pi L squared R horizon divided by 2 R horizon squared plus L squared. Now, in analogy with Euclidean field theory, the periodicity of Euclidean time tells you the temperature of the system. In particular, beta, the inverse temperature in this case then, is equal to L squared R horizon over 2 R horizon squared plus L squared. Okay. Okay. So let me draw a picture of this. So we have an equation here relating then the inverse temperature of the black hole to the horizon radius. So we can draw a picture. Here's a nice place to draw a picture of beta as a function of RH to see what happens. And the thing you immediately notice is that as RH goes to infinity, of course, beta goes to zero. So it's going to go down like this. And as RH goes to zero, also beta goes to zero. And it peaks up somewhere between, so it goes like this. So we can conclude immediately various things from this. First of all, there is a maximum beta, which means there is a minimum T, minimum temperature T, for ADS black holes. This is very different from flap space, where a black hole can have any temperature you choose, as small as you want and as big as you want. Here, black holes only exist above a certain temperature. Below the temperature, the only thermal objects that are there are thermal gases. We heat the thing up, we get some gas of particles, everything gets excited. And then when you go over a certain temperature, it's also possible to nucleate black holes. So it's convenient for my purposes to rewrite our horizon to solve for our horizon in terms of the temperature, because a thing we will want is fix the temperature and find out what sizes of black holes can be there. And our horizon is equal to, if you just work out the algebra, is equal to L squared over 4 beta times 1 plus or minus 1 minus 4 beta squared over L squared. So this is equal to, as beta goes to infinity, this is equal to L squared over, error in the formula. Rewrite this. So first of all, this is equal to 1 plus or minus the square root of 1 minus 8 beta squared over L squared, which therefore at small beta, as beta goes to 0 at very high temperatures, this is L squared over 4 beta times 1 plus or minus 1 minus 4 beta squared over L squared, which of course has two solutions. One is L squared over 4 beta, which is going to infinity as beta goes to 0, and also beta, which is going to 0 as beta goes to 0. So what we're seeing here is as you get to very high temperatures, there are two black hole solutions. One of them has a horizon that's shrinking and becoming very small. In fact, it's shrinking to be much smaller than the ADS radius, so it's going to act like a black hole in flat space. And the other solution is growing to very large size as beta goes to 0, so it's becoming an enormous black hole, much bigger than the curvature scale of anti-de Sitter space. Okay. Also, for beta greater than L over 2 root 2, there are no black holes at all. So I'm going to call the plus branch here the large black holes, not surprisingly, and I'm going to call the minus branch here the small black holes. And there are many facts about these things that are useful, and which would have also appeared possibly in Sujong's lectures on thermal ADS, they might have appeared in Sujong's lectures and will appear again in Ofer's lectures next week. So I'm going to list some of the facts that are true about these black holes. So the large black holes have positive specific heat. While the small black holes have negative specific heat. What this means is that if you want to increase the temperature of the large black holes, you need to increase the mass of the black hole. Whereas here, if you want to increase the temperature of the black hole, you decrease the mass of the black hole, just like you would in flat space. Right? It's making sense that the small black holes are acting like black holes in flat space, where the temperature increases as the mass decreases. I will say much more about that in a second. So why is this happening? Well, one of the first reasons, well, the reason is that the small black holes act like in flat space. And can evaporate, just like black holes in flat space can. So if you nucleate one of these things in anti-de Sitter space, it sort of boils off its energy, eventually heats up, and then it's gone after a while. Whereas the large black holes, which have R horizon bigger than about the ADS scale, come into equilibrium with radiation. So in fact, for this region, the last part of this lecture, and certainly in this evening's lecture, I will be very interested in these black holes because they're stable in the sense that they come to equilibrium with the radiation. So I can talk about them in an easier way in the Yang-Mills theory. So I'm going to do that. There's an additional subtlety that is worth taking into account, and that is the following. Let's write down the entropy of the small black holes. So you take that thing, you hear the entropy is going to be area over 4 g newton. And if you plug in all the variables, you know, work out the horizon, plug things in, and then here's what you find for what the entropy is. It turns out to be L to the 8, the ADS scale to the 8, over the 10-dimensional Newton constant. So this is going to be like n squared, as usual, times the 10-dimensional Newton constant times the mass of the black hole divided by the ADS scale to the 7th raised to the 3/2. You should work this out. It's an elementary exercise in computing the area over there, dividing by G Newton and rearranging the parameters. So let me call this SADS. But if you're talking about a black hole that's smaller than the anti-de Sitter scale, it's important to remember that there's also a sphere here whose size is the same as anti-de Sitter scale. So if we're talking about things that's sufficiently small there, then the sphere in this geometry, in the ADS-5 plus S5, is on the same footing as the ADS-5. So you have to ask the question, let me compare the entropy of this thing, which is sort of a black hole localized in 5 dimensions, but kind of smeared out over the S5. Let me compare the entropy of that to a black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole, honest to God, that's localized in flat 10-dimensional space, right, in this large region. Did you follow that? Okay. So if you do that, The 10-dimensional black hole entropy for a black hole of the same mass is 1 over G10 times the mass times G10 raised to the power 8/7. That's because now we're talking about a metric that looks like ds squared is equal to minus 1 minus gm over r to the 7th dt squared plus the same thing, inverse dr squared plus r squared times an 8 sphere. This is a 10-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. So the picture here is that you have anti-de Sitter space across a sphere. And this black hole is sufficiently small that, you know, it's at a, so to speak, at the point in the sphere and the point in the bulk. And so locally, the space looks flat, and I can just describe it by this metric for extracting the entropy. Okay, so if you do that and compute the 10-dimensional entropy, then what you find here is this is L to the 8 over G10, G10, M over L squared, power 8/7. And this is greater than this 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter entropy we found. So we should expect that there's an entropic instability for this black hole, for the small black hole to localize onto the 5-sphere. This argument was made in a couple of papers. One was a paper by Banks, Douglas, Horowitz, and Martinek. And particularly nicely, there's a paper by Ross and Pete, which makes these arguments in a nice way in many different cases. So we can go there to look at them. But this implies that there is an instability in this black hole that should cause it to localize onto the S5. So in fact, this problem is a window into many other such localization instabilities that are there in higher dimensional gravity. I'll just mention a couple of them, and you can go read about them if you're interested. There is, for example, the Gregory-Laflamme instability, which says that under certain circumstances, a black string, rather than a black hole wrapped on a circle, will tend to localize itself into becoming a localized black hole. So here's a black string, whether that goes into a localized black hole. And it's been argued by Horowitz and collaborators and many people afterwards, et al., plus references, that in fact, this localization instability may not lead to a black hole per se, but rather to sort of a wiggly string, which is sort of inhomogeneous in its structure, sort of like beads on a necklace, that kind of thing. So there's been a discussion about that. And this remains an important and interesting problem in both in classical general relativity and string theory, which of these different things happens. So people try to these days study this even in numerical relativity. The fate of these things is not yet known, so it's an interesting thing to think about. In particular, no one has actually demonstrated that this localization actually happens. So it would be interesting to understand that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What's the latest news? Who from? By who? Okay. Okay, so that is a useful clarification. As you can see, it's very much a subject that people still work on, both in numerical relativity and using other methods. And there are people in the audience who worked on this too. Okay, so that's a comment I wanted to make. Also, so now we're going to shift gears a little bit. Also, as we've said before, ADS basically implements a box, as we've said before, because the geometry effectively implements a potential well. If you put things in anti-de Sitter space, it's basically like putting things into a box. So because you basically put things into a box, you can consistently discuss the canonical ensemble in these systems. In flat, empty space, the canonical ensemble, namely the theory of systems at finite temperature, is hard to discuss because if you heat the thing up, well, you know, there's an infinite amount of space in which for you to put stuff, so you'll get an infinite amount of energy spreading out into the infinite amount of space. So, but in anti-de Sitter space, that's not going to happen, so you can discuss what the canonical ensemble looks like. So in particular, if you talk about the canonical ensemble, namely the finite temperature ensemble of all spaces, of all asymptotically ADS spaces, according to the ADS-CFT correspondence, this should be equivalent to the thermal ensemble 4, n equals 4, super Yang-Mills theory. So let me discuss that for a few minutes. Okay, so in the semi-classical limit, what this would basically say is that if you sum over so you go to the Euclidean section, because the canonical ensemble is done with, you know, periodic time to mimic the finite temperature. So if you go to the Euclidean section, then you can sum over the Euclidean saddle points in asymptotically ADS space. So these are Euclidean saddle points, or Euclidean solutions of the theory. This should be equal to the thermal partition function of Yang-Mills theory. So these are all saddle points with chi identified, the Euclidean time identified as chi plus 2 pi beta. And of course, looking at this formula, it's obvious that the solution with lowest action dominates. And if you have situations where as you crank or change the temperature, the solution which has the lowest action changes, then you will have a phase transition. Right, so you'll have a phase transition in the space-time, and it's interesting to understand whether that's related to a phase transition in the field theory. Okay, so we already said that at small temperatures, there's only one saddle point in the action. Namely, there's only one solution to the equations of motion. We already found that out because at low temperatures, there are no black holes, and the only solution in time is just empty anti-de Sitter space with time made periodic at the appropriate period. At large temperature, we've already said, there are three saddle points. There's the thermal ADS, the small black hole, and the large black hole. So we'd like to see a picture of what's going on here. So here, we would say that if there's only one saddle point, if you imagine the space of configurations, it's as if I look at the space of configurations, and I look at actions in the space of configurations, of Euclidean configurations, and there's only one minimum, and here, the picture should be something like this. There should be three extrema with one maximum. So how does that come about? Okay, so here's how we can see something like this happening. We can compute, remember yesterday, we wrote down the improved action for anti-de Sitter spaces, right? We wrote down the action for the bulk, and we added these boundary counterterms, et cetera. So given a solution, we can always plug it in into that action and compute what the action, classical action, for a given space is. And in this way, we can find out the contributions of different spaces to the canonical ensemble. So let's do that. And here I'm going to write down the action of thermal ADS minus the actions for the black hole solutions as a function of a parameter x, which is equal to the horizon radius over the ADS scale. And here's what you find. The picture looks like that. And you know, this is a computation that you can easily do. And maybe that's an exercise that you should carry out. Plug in the solutions we've described into the action, find the expression, and then plot it in Mathematica or something. Here's the peak. What's that? The vertical axis is the action of thermal ADS minus the action of the black holes as a function of the horizon area, horizon radius of the black hole. Okay? So not surprisingly, on this side are the small black holes. On this side are the large black holes. And going this way is going to high temperature, because as you recall, increasing the temperature makes the large black holes bigger. And going this way is also high temperature, because increasing the temperature makes the small black holes smaller. Okay? So here are the two directions. So let's draw another picture. Let me digest this picture in a different way. What I want to draw is a picture of the action in configuration space as a function of the temperature parameter. And we'll see how the action changes when you change the temperature parameter. I should say, there is a sense in which these pictures I'm drawing are very misleading, because of course the configuration space in gravity is huge, and I'm drawing it as a one-dimensional picture, so there's something slightly misleading about that, but there's a shortage of dimensions on the blackboard. So here, this is at the lowest temperature, we have one minimum, this is thermal ADS, and then we increase temperatures And what that, if you sort of take, you start here and then you start moving out at the critical temperature, you start seeing what these different, what the action for the small, what I'm doing is I'm cranking up the temperature and the temperature comes down, down, down. Eventually when I find the temperature here, I find a temperature where there are two solutions there, then another two solutions, another two solutions, and I'm going to write down the action of this one, the small black hole, and the action of this one, the large black hole, and I'm plotting that in this picture. What you find is that you get something like that. This is the small, this is the large black hole, and this is thermal ADS. Then you increase the temperature some more, and this turns over to make this large black hole smaller. This is the small black hole, and this is thermal ADS. And eventually, this keeps going so that this becomes more like, you know. So this is actions as a function of the configuration space. And I'm pretending the configuration space is one-dimensional, and then you know this keeps going like this, so that the large black hole becomes ever more preferred. So what we should do is when this action, when the action for the large black hole becomes smaller than the action for the more negative, if you like, than the action for the for thermal ADS, we expect a phase transition. And this phase transition is famous. It's the Hawking-Page phase transition. And the question arises, what is the Hawking-Page phase transition? It's a dramatic phenomenon in gravity, where you have thermal gas below a certain temperature, which suddenly collapses into a very big black hole. So this phase transition, what does that correspond to as a phenomenon in the field theory? So that is a question that's not been 100% settled, because it's very hard to compute in the field theory at strong coupling, where we are, which is the regime that is relevant here. But you can argue that it should be something like a deconfinement transition for the field theory. Sujong almost certainly told you about thermal ADS space describing a confined, how Yang-Mills and thermal Yang-Mills confines, and then when you heat it up sufficiently, deconfines. And so that transition between confinement and deconfinement is likely related to this, and I'll make an argument that's likely related, and then point you to some references. So, okay, so let's consider how do we see this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to argue that the entropy of the large black holes scales like the degrees of freedom in the deconfinement theory, in the deconfined theory. So if you consider a large black hole with mass parameter much, much bigger than the ADS scale, then using the formulae I had written down earlier, you find that the horizon radius goes like the ADS scale times the square root of R naught. Then you plug this into the entropy is the area over 4 g newton, and go through the same rigmarole that I've been going through all along, convert 5-dimensional g newton into a 10-dimensional g newton by using the string coupling and the string scale, et cetera, work everything out. And at the end of the day, you'll find that this goes like n squared, which is, of course, going like the number of gluons in the field theory, which is very satisfying, because that feels exactly right for the entropy of a deconfined phase of a field theory. So there are a number of papers that have been lately trying to address this issue. There's an original work by Witten from the late 90s called, I forget what it was called, Thermal ADS and something or the other. There are papers by Bo Sundborg, which are very nice, trying to explicitly calculate the effective action in the Yang-Mills theory that is relevant for this process. And there are some recent papers by Aharoni et al. Minwala Papadodimos, who I think is in the audience somewhere, and Marsano, Mark von Ramsdonk, various people. Okay, fine. Infinite authors and infinitely many pages, but a careful work. Okay, so you should look at all of that. Square root of R naught for large values. What is the time? Ah, it keeps saying I have a new message. I don't want to know that I have a new message. What's the time? Okay, 10:45. 10:45? Excellent. Perfect. So, okay, great. So now, the usual, so now I'm going to start actually going towards the quantum foam that I had promised you at the beginning of this lecture that I would get to by the end. I'll get to the end of it by the next lecture I give, of course, but let's start setting up. So given this entire picture of black holes and the manifest connection with the thermal physics of Yang-Mills theory, the usual statement that we make is that a black hole in anti-de Sitter space is equivalent to or dual to the thermal state of Yang-Mills theory. And that, of course, immediately poses lots of puzzling questions. One of the famous questions about black holes is if you stick something inside, well, it doesn't come back out, classically. And quantum mechanically, according to Hawking, the radiation looks thermal, so you never get back any information. So this is the famous information loss paradox. Another puzzle about black holes is that, I drew the Penrose diagram somewhere, is that there is a singularity. And we would like to know how the singularity inside the black hole is resolved, perhaps, in a quantum theory of gravity like string theory. And also famously, doing this for Schwarzschild black holes is one hell of a difficult problem. Every example where we've actually succeeded in giving that treatment, in resolving singularities in that way in string theory, it's always singularities that are localized in space. And the generic mechanism, there's also null singularities occasionally you can do, but they're generally singularities localized in space. And the basic mechanism for resolving singularities in string theory is always the appearance of new like degrees of freedom. So for example, in the case of orbifolds, where you've identified, let's say, this with this, so that you have a cone, the new like degrees of freedom are the twisted sector strings, which are, of course, the ones trapped around the tip of the cone. In the case of singularities that are resolved by the presence of D-brains, the new like degrees of freedom are the open strings that are attached to the supposedly singular locus. So it's this kind of thing that happens again and again and again. It's the same philosophy as in field theory. If you write down a low-energy effective field theory, right, and integrate out some fields, and it so happens that in some regime of parameters or dynamics, one of those fields becomes light or massless, then you made a mistake integrating it out, and a low-energy effective description of the physics will look singular, right? And so you need to bring that stuff back down in your analysis. And that's the basic philosophy for resolution of singularities localized in space everywhere. And that philosophy has failed miserably for singularities localized in time, like the singularity in the middle of a Schwarzschild black hole, which is localized in time, and for the singularities that occur, let's say, at the Big Bang, which are also localized in time. We just don't know how to deal with those things in that language. So what I would like to do in my remaining time today and in the next lecture is to suggest a very different perspective on how we should think about these problems of singularity resolution and getting information out from behind the horizon. And the perspective that I'm going to use is the obvious one. That is, we already know that if we're thinking about, let's say, the physics of the gas in this room, the thermodynamics, complete with density matrices and loss of information and sort of this as entropy increases and so on and so forth, all of that is simply the effective, in fact, even the mean field, typically, description of underlying pure quantum states. And to the extent that we're supposed to know that we have this black hole here as a solution in the theory, and that there are underlying states, and one presumes, in string theory describing this black hole, well, those states must somehow be like the, well, describing the state of space-time in the same way that the positions and momenta of all the gas molecules in this room describe the real state of this of the gas, and PV equals nRT is merely the long wavelength approximation to the physics. So we would like to develop that perspective in detail and see that from that perspective, there is no information loss problem, cannot be, and also give some idea as to how the singularities in this case might be resolved. Okay, so what I'm going to do in the next lecture mostly, but also I'm going to start now, is I'm going to start out by discussing Schwarzschild black holes, again, in ADS, because we're discussing the ADS CFT correspondence, and as you will see, the dual field theory gives particularly powerful tools for this particular question. And then I will discuss a similar thing for the half BPS states of the theory. As you will see for the Schwarzschild black hole, I hope you'll find the arguments convincing, but it's hard to make them completely rigorous because lack of supersymmetry means that things like the energies of states are not protected from renormalization. And it'll be very convenient to talk about also a system, you know, after having done the discussion for the thing we really want to know about, to also discuss a toy model where the energies of states are protected from quantum corrections so that I can do all calculations exactly. In this situation, there'll be absolutely no doubt that we can do everything that is necessary. So that is going to be the plan. What's that? I'm going to tell you. That's the whole plan. They can find my notes. Right. So let me start again by mentioning the, once again, okay, let's do the Schwarzschild, we're doing the Schwarzschild black hole again. And this time, taking a different perspective on it, I don't want to think about it as exactly a thermal state. I've already told you that the metric looks like minus 1 plus r squared over l squared minus r naught squared over r squared dt squared plus the same thing inverse dr squared plus r squared the omega squared. And I've worked out for you the horizon radius and the various other parameters. So because of that, I won't work them out again. I'll just merely remind you that we worked out that the mass of the black hole was r naught squared over g phi. For I'm always going to take r naught much, much bigger than l, so that I'm ignoring the Casimir energy part. You remember there was a constant piece. I'm going to drop that from now on because it's going to be a minor perturbation to everything I'm trying to say. And then, at some point, we discussed the map from space-time masses and energies into field theory conformal dimensions. And for the particular case at hand here, that translates into you multiply the mass by the ADS scale, and you work out what all of that corresponds to. You can convince yourself that the mass times the ADS scale, well, the mass times the ADS scale is going to be the conformal dimension. And I'm going to think about large black holes because I want stable black holes which are stable objects in the field theory. I don't want to deal with the issue of radiation and decay of the system. So I'm going to take large black holes for which R naught, as we've said before, for which the horizon radius, let's say, is of order L. And using the formula relating the mass parameter R naught to R horizon, and we did this before, about half an hour before, you can show that when this is the case, when the black hole is large, R naught is also of order L. And plugging everything together, you can work out that the conformal dimension of an operator that is dual to a microstate of the black hole, and here I'm taking a microcanonical perspective, right, the actual states that are underlying the huge entropy of the black hole, must have a conformal dimension, which is, m times L. And putting things together, so this goes like L naught squared over G5. So putting that in, this looks like L cubed over G5. We've seen this formula, L cubed over G5, many, many times in the current lectures. And every time it comes out, we take G5, the five-dimensional Newton constant, translate it into a 10-dimensional Newton constant times the volume of the internal sphere. We crank, and after 10 seconds, we come out always with the answer N squared. And therefore, it's still going to be N squared. I want to point out that notice that the conformal dimension of an operator that's dual to black hole microstate is independent of the coupling of the Yang-Mills theory. This should be surprising because, as we said also yesterday, the conformal dimension in the Lorentzian description, the conformal dimension is the energy of the state created by the dual operator. And the states we're talking about are not supersymmetric because, the Schwarzschild black hole isn't supersymmetric. So there's no reason whatsoever that these energies shouldn't renormalize like mad. Nevertheless, it's a surprising fact that whatever they do, at the end of the day, the actual energy of these underlying microstates is independent of the coupling. So there's some weird property about these very classical states that as you crank or change the coupling, the actual energy of the underlying state doesn't change, which is somehow very surprising and hasn't really been understood. Yeah. Hi. What's that? Are the subleading corrections to this, by that you mean alpha prime corrections and such? I'm not sure. That will become an interesting question in the middle of my next lecture. But I'm not sure. In this case, for the Schwarzschild black hole, the dominant term in the area and the entropy is, in any case, the classical one, so we don't care. But for the half-BPS states, there is no classical entropy. So then it becomes very important to ask the question whether alpha prime corrections correct that. Good? All right. So here's what I would like to say. That a black hole, as I said, is usually described as a black hole is a thermal state in the field theory. But baloney. We want to take the, you know, honest to God, microcanonical perspective that Boltzmann would have taught us gives rise to the statistical features of gases. So we want to say that a black hole is dual. A particular black hole, shall we say state, a particular state of the black hole is dual to a certain operator acting on the vacuum, where the conformal dimension of the operator is of order n squared, because we just worked that out. Let me give you some scales for comparison, just so that you appreciate what an enormous operator we're talking about, how heavy a state we're talking about. Yesterday, we worked out in gory detail the conformal dimension of operators that are dual to small supergravity modes. So the graviton, the dilaton, you know, all kinds of things like that, Kaluza-Klein mode. You remember we wrote on a formula for the conformal dimension. You may not remember, but if you check your notes, you will see it. And in all of those cases, if you look at the conformal dimension, it's order one, by which I mean it's some number that's independent of the coupling and that's independent of n, the rank of the gauge group. Strings, by contrast, have a conformal dimension that goes like g string n to the 1/4, which is the Toft coupling to the 1/4. I'm not going to go through in detail as to how I derive this in a minute. And d-brains, which are even heavier objects, have a conformal dimension that goes like n. I haven't explained that to you yet. In the next lecture, it'll become evident when I'll present some evidence that I'll show you that this is the case. So basically, black holes are extremely heavy objects that are like n d-brains. And n here is, of course, going to infinity to give us a semi-classical space-time. So we're talking about enormously heavy objects from the perspective of the field theory. And it's that enormous size that we're very unfamiliar with that's going to produce all the interesting effects. The enormous size of these operators that we're unfamiliar with that is going to produce the effects that we're going to be interested in. Let me also remind you that the entropy of these black holes is supposed to go like, again, r horizon cubed of g phi. We worked this out before, and this came out like n squared, so it goes like delta. So we're expecting, if Boltzmann's treatment of statistical mechanics continues to apply in this situation, we should expect that there are e to the n squared operators of conformal dimension n squared. This is an enormous growth of the number of operators. Okay. And you can make some argument that you will actually get that number out. But I won't try to do that. I should be basically out of time. Yes, I have a minute, so I'll end with one comment that will set up for what I have to say this evening. So the question I want to ask is, what do such operators look like? Let's just write them down and see what they look like, and if you try to calculate things in states made by these operators, what answer will you get? Okay, so let's go. The fields of the Yang-Mills theory are the gauge field, a bunch of fermions, and three complex scalar fields, x, y, z. Of course, x bar, y bar, and z bar are also included. That's the first statement. We need to make states in this theory that are gauge invariant, and also Lorentz invariant, etc. What do gauge invariant operators look like? Well, up to subtleties that I will discuss in the evening. They are basically long polynomials. Polynomials in the fields with, so to speak, indices contracted. In other words, you need to multiply everything out so that Lorentz indices contract to singlets and gauge indices contract to singlets. Let me write down an example of an operator. Here's O, trace X, X, Y, Y, Z, trace Y, Y, Z, Z, X, blah, 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 blah. Of course, you're perfectly free to add in a mu, psi, you're free to add in derivatives, you're free to add in X bars, you're free to add in whatever you want. Okay? But in general, they look like these very long polynomials with traces thrown in. And for the purposes of our argument, what we're going to think about is the argument will not change depending upon, you know, how many fields I use or exactly how I put in the derivatives, etc. So for the moment, I'm going to ignore the details about how you contract the gauge indices, namely how many traces you put in, and just pretend that I can write down all the operators as a single trace of a very, very long polynomial in the scalar fields. The essential arguments that I have to make will not change when I add in the other fields and the derivatives, etc., and it's just simply easier to think in this language. So the exercise that I would like you guys to carry out before we meet again in the evening is to think about, if you construct very long operators out of a finite alphabet, what can you say, if anything, about the structure of the very long operators? Right? And there, it turns out there are many powerful things you can say about their structure, which will essentially control the black hole-like behavior of these states. Okay, so you should think about that. I'll stop now.